Welcome to the World Art Now podcast, exploring the world through the material culture of its people, in association with Michael Backman Limited.
Hi, this is Sarah Corbett and I'm with Michael Backman today, and we're going to discuss the use of beetle. So, Michael, what is beetle?
Well, beetle is a... Firstly, it's a mild social narcotic. It comes from a palm tree, particularly the nut, which is known as an areca nut, grows in the tropics, say in Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Thailand, and so on. It's very tall, very thin, and the nuts are very small. They're not like coconuts. They're more like probably the size of a walnut or even smaller. And these are used in conjunction with the beetle leaf, which is a type of creeper, which the nut is then sliced up, put in the creeper leaf with powdered lime, and that causes a chemical reaction when you chew the whole lot in your mouth, and it releases sort of like a... It's a very light type of drug. It's a bit like when you're young and you have your first ever cigarette. You get that lightheaded feeling. So that's what beetle does. And people, they'll sit together and share it. Traditionally, they used to do this as a social narcotic, a bit like sitting around drinking tea or sharing whiskey or something like that. And so people would get together and chew beetle as a social activity.
And where? Where would you find it in use?
Right across Southeast Asia, but also in the subtropical warmer parts of the Himalayas and India, where it's called pan. The one place where it's still openly used and popularly used is of all places, Taiwan. So when you go to like a sporting match, very often there'll be often scantily clad ladies who will be the betel nut sellers pushing this sort of drug and almost in lieu of cigarettes at sporting fixtures.
So who uses it? Would it be a male-dominated activity?
No, not everyone used it. Of course, it's dying out now. Apart from Taiwan, you don't generally come across betel nut chewers anymore. But it was people of all ages and both sexes and at all levels of society. The only thing that differed was the accoutrements used in conjunction with its usage. So certain things were used, like to cut the nut, for example, you have betel nut shears, and they could be very rudimentary for poor people. And of course, as you got richer, the more fabulous they became.
And what else would you expect to find within the paraphernalia that someone who used betel would be in possession of to enjoy the...
Well, it's a good question, particularly from a collecting point of view, because betel nut equipment now is very collectible, particularly those items that we use for the upper echelons of Southeast Asian and Indian society. So you'd have a betel nut set, would have various jars and little bottles and flasks and so on for the various elements that went into the betel nut quid. Then you'd have the betel nut shears or scissors, which in some Malay culture were called kachip in Malay language. And if you didn't have the scissors or the shears to cut the nut, in the Mekong area, they would tend to use a small knife to cut and slice the nut. There could also be a spittoon. So once you've chewed the nut, you don't swallow the fibrous residue, you would spit it out. And in polite society, you would spit it into a spittoon. If you're inside, you'd pass around a handheld spittoon. If you're outside, you just spit it onto the ground. And this is where the red staining comes from as well. It would tend to stain your lips red, but also when people would spit it into the street, you then see a red splodge mark everywhere you'd go.
Like a map of betel use.
Yes, indeed, like a trail. So, and in fact, even here in London, this is very interesting. Today, the Bangladeshi community, the older ones in particular, will still tend to chew it. And if you go to areas of London which where the Bangladeshis are quite populous, particularly in the East End of London, around Brick Lane and so on, you can still sometimes see red beetle stains on the curbs and so on, on the footpaths where they've spat it out.
So is it considered a healthy thing to do? Are there implications around the use that people felt were beneficial to their health?
Yes, it was always seen as a healthy thing. It was felt to keep your breath clean and sweet smelling, and also your teeth quite white. And in the Victorian era, it was actually an additive to Victorian toothpaste in England. So they would import betel nut from Southeast Asia and India and so on, and grind it up and add it to the toothpaste. Now, however, it's felt that it's possibly correlated with throat cancer and mouth cancer and so on. So it's, again, with all these things, if you overuse it, it's going to be harmful to your health.
So it's... Its significance within religious use, are there elements of societies that used it where it was used with, say, a celebration or a rite of passage
an event? Yes, indeed. Certainly, it could be a legitimate offering in Bali. People will often slice up little bits of betel nut and or even a whole betel quid and make it as an offering to deities. Along with other things like foods and things like that, and along with incense and so on. And also in Malay culture, it would be one of the things that was used in conjunction with an offer of marriage. So you would visit a prospective bride's parents and bring along a betel nut set, and you'd offer it to them and ask for their daughter's hand in marriage. And if the offer was accepted, they would partake of the betel. Everyone would sit around taking betel to sort of seal the deal. If the offer of marriage was rejected, they would actually upend the betel nut set and turn the betel nuts, you know, onto the tray. And that was a sign that they were refusing their daughter's hand in marriage. Elsewhere, it would be used just in social contexts, often to seal a deal. One of the interesting things out of this was that when the Dutch colonized what became Indonesia, when they wanted to sort of negotiate rice trading deals or land deals with the local rajas and the local sultans and so on, they would be invited to take betel. And so the Dutch themselves got hooked on betel. And this was also the case with the Dutch in Sri Lanka as well, in it used to be known as Ceylon. And they took up the habit of betel to the point where I believe they would keep up with the habit back in Holland. So when they went back to the Netherlands, that they were still chewing betel, which would be imported for them. And then the Dutch, and particularly the Dutch women themselves, ended up having fabulous betel nut sets, to the point where in Sri Lanka, the VOC, the Dutch East India Company, had to pass laws prohibiting over-jeweled and over-rich sets because, in fact, the women were over-investing in them, buying sets that were far too expensive and competing with one another, which to the point where it was becoming ruinous to their husbands because they were spending far too much on these wonderful sets. And then they would go on these very elaborate processions, almost like mini sultans themselves, mini kings and rajas, on their way to church on a Sunday, where a Dutch wife would go along with one of her slaves behind her, carrying a betel nut set that was bejeweled with, you know, gold and ivory and rubies and so on. Behind that slave would be another slave carrying an umbrella, and then there'd be another slave carrying perhaps the stool that she would sit on in the church, and then there'd be another slave carrying the spittoon that the wife would be spitting her betel spittle into. And so this became such an elaborate procession, and the wives would be trying to out-compete each other with the numbers of slaves and the fineness of the betel nut sets.
So there was perceived status in showing the most valuable and the most opulent spittoon and paraphernalia as you were seen in the street.
Indeed, and now some of the rarest, most fabulous objects you can get hold of from a collector's point of view, we utterly bejeweled betel nut sets, studded with emeralds and diamonds and so on. And it's not necessarily the case that these belong to the local indigenous rulers. They could well have been Dutch officials and so on. I don't think the English ever got into this. The English stuck to their cups of tea and so on and cigars. But for some reason, the Dutch were very big on this. And so today, one good place to find fabulous old betel nut sets and paraphernalia will be in Holland.
I was going to make the point that many things found their way into European households at these times as the possessions of people returning from spending time in these countries with the, for example, the Dutch East India Company,
yes,
or other colonial persons overseas.
Yes, yes.
So it brings a wealth of incredible, intricate workmanship from these origins into European households.
Yes, no, it's almost counterintuitive that one of the good places now to find betel nut paraphernalia is not Southeast Asia or India or Burma or themselves, but England and the Netherlands. These are the sets that have great provenance going back to maybe the 18th century when the Dutch were bringing them back and the British were bringing them back as souvenirs.
So the use of betel has declined now in most of the countries,
yes,
where it was originally used.
Yes.
Is this just because it's seen as an old-fashioned and outdated concept,
yes,
to use it, or is it because people have associations with health problems that maybe they've been educated that it's not a positive thing to continue to use?
It's fallen out of fashion, and when you talk to people in, say, Malaysia or Indonesia or India today, they associate betel nut use with older people, so it's not cool. Maybe cigarettes and drinking whiskey is more cool, but betel nut is something you would associate maybe with what your grandmother would do. And certainly older people, maybe poorer people as well. Certainly in parts of India, you do still come across betel nut users, but it often say there'll be a betel nut, or they call it pan, so there'll be like a pan stall in a street market. And then very often the people who will be buying it will tend to be maybe the poorer people and so on. It's not something you'd associate with more educated people today.
So the older traditions of use of pan have continued with perhaps people who've had less access to education or wealth rather than being widespread across the whole community.
Yes, yes. And so therefore the sets that might still be made today for use are more utilitarian than fabulous. Certainly the sets of the past of the 18th century when you know, maybe the various Maharajas and the rulers had these sets that they were just astonishing. You know, they were the equivalent of, say, the 18th century British having the most, the finest tea sets and whatever. So the equivalent in Indonesia or Malaysia or Malaya as it was then, or Thailand or India, the equivalents then would be just the most astounding sets made of gold and silver and ivory and so on.
And very much part of serving your guests in the most decadent and opulent
Absolutely.
Fashion possible.
Yes,
it's fits status.
Indeed, it's all about status and hospitality and just showing off. And also, something I should have added before in terms of ritual and so on, that very often a ruler, perhaps it might have been like the Sultan of Pahang in Malaya, or the King of Thailand, or the King of Siam as it was then. All of these sort of sultans and rajas and kings and so on, part of their royal regalia would be a betel nut set, and very often a spittoon. That certainly, when you see old black and white photos of the King of Siam, or Thailand as it's known today, always at the king's feet will be a massive spittoon to signify his status, and it would have been made of gold.
And part of what made him the powerful ruler of the country is being seen with these important cultural aspects.
That's totally true. And what's so interesting in these sorts of countries, historically, traditionally, it's the reverse of how we would see it in Europe, European society. In the kings and queens of Europe would have these sorts of objects, not obviously betel nut sets, but they'd have a scepter and an orb and a crown and so on. The possession of these objects signified that you were royal, but they did not confer on you your royal status. But the reverse is true in Southeast Asia, where these objects made you royal,
mm-hmm,
but they weren't so much a sign of your royalness or your royalty, but they actually conferred on you that status. And so in Southeast Asia, the trick to becoming royal was to capture someone's betel nut set and to capture the royal sword of state. Your mere possession of these objects conferred on you the right to rule, rather than being a sign of your right to rule.
So you can see hereditary possessions.
Ah, absolutely.
So the title passes with the possession rather with the birthright.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So if anybody that's listening today wanted to check out some amazing objects related to the use of betel, is there a museum where they would find exquisite examples that you could point them towards?
Yeah, certainly. most of the museums in Southeast Asia have wonderful items, and of course in India as well, so where you know traditionally betel use was prevalent. The Victoria and Albert Museum in London has some splendid examples. Some of the more important museums in the United States have excellent examples. If you go to their websites and search online and put in betel, which is B-E-T-E-L, or pan, P-A-A-N, then some of these objects will appear. But certainly many are on display in you know some of the world's major museums.
I think for collectors it's particularly appealing that the entry point can be at more humble belongings around the use of betel or at the very high end. So there's a whole spectrum of objects and the expensive through to the very utilitarian pieces. It means it's an area for collecting that many people could find an access point into.
That's a very good point, because betel usage was so widespread in so many countries where the nut actually grew, and at every echelon of society people were using it, so therefore at every level these objects are available. One more interesting point was that there was a lot of trade in these objects between countries within Asia. And I remember once walking down a street in Jakarta in Indonesia where there are a lot of antique shops and so on. I think it's called Jalan Surabaya. And I came across quite a few betel nut cutters, and which is not surprising because it was a betel consuming society. But what was interesting is that the betel nut cutters had on them Karimnagar. They were stamped with the word Karimnagar, which is a place in India. So in fact these cutters had been made in India for export to Indonesia, and vice versa. I've come across Philippines boxes from Manado and Mindanao, in other countries where betel nut usage is prevalent. And so these objects were being traded around and made for export to other countries.
And there's that sense of it being more exotic because it came from elsewhere, and so using it set you apart from using a local version of the object?
Yes, I think so. But also maybe it was simply just a measure of for these more utilitarian examples, it was just simply they were being made more cheaply and efficiently in India. Another interesting thing is that I have come across sets made in Germany and in the United Kingdom for export to India and Malaysia. So where, like Waterford Crystal, for example, or WMF, like a maker of plated silver goods in Germany, was making, and Sheffield Plate as well in the UK, were actually making betel nut sets for export in the early 20th century to Southeast Asia and India. Now, these are very rare, and these are very collectible, very desirable. And it's almost unthinkable to imagine that you know the great sort of economies of Europe and whatever were making these very humble sets for export to Southeast Asia.
The trade routes of the world never fail to fascinate. The things that move in one direction and back the other way. It's just an endless stream of communication of ideas and concepts.
Yes, we always think of trade between, in those earlier days, between sort of Europe and Asia as being one way, that you know Europe was taking stuff and importing things from Asia, but in fact it was very much the other way. Obviously we know with textiles that was very common. But it's phenomenal to think that betel nut sets were being made in Germany and the UK for export to India and Southeast Asia.
What a fascinating topic. I'm glad we've been able to share some time going over some of the details of what's involved in using betel and about the people that used it.
Indeed,
hopefully people will enjoy looking into the intricacies of the use and also the amazing material culture around the use of betel around the world. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you.
You have been listening to the World Art Now podcast in association with Michael Backman Limited. To hear more, visit worldartnow.com.